Triathlon Show 286. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Björn Kafka. Björn is a German cycling coach and endurance sports coach at the very highest level, working with many world-class cyclists in particular. He's also an expert in metabolism and metabolic calculations, and is involved in AeroTune, and is the man behind the AeroTune power test, which gives athletes access to metabolic testing with a testing protocol that can be done remotely, but with really in-depth information as a result of that, that can give you a deeper understanding of your own physiology. So in this interview, we dive into lots of topics, including metabolism, testing, but also just general training from not necessarily only a metabolic and testing perspective, but equally so just from Björn's coaching experience perspective. So a great multifaceted interview, and I really, really enjoyed chatting to Björn. But before we get into the interview, a big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Roka, that are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swim skins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. Roka started out as a wetsuit company, and put a gun to my head, and if I had to answer which is my favorite Roka product, I would without hesitation say that it's the Maverick X2 wetsuit. But Roka has wetsuits for suitable for every level of athlete and every budget for wetsuits, from the entry-level Maverick Comp 2 to that Maverick X2 model with everything in between, including also having a thermal wetsuit for colder water swimming and a swim run wetsuit for those interested in the fantastic and really fun sport of swim run. All of Roka's wetsuits have their patented arms up technology. They are based on premium materials and lots of other bells and whistles that you can read about on the Roka website. And the Roka's wetsuits are trusted by athletes such as Javier Gomez and Lucy Charles Barclay, and are really, really top quality. You can go to roka.com/TTS and get 20% off your order on Roka's wetsuits or any other Roka products. And thank you to Sen8 that you can find on sen8swimtrainer.com. The Sen8 Swim Trainer is an inflatable bench that you use in conjunction with stretch cords, so that you can do basically stretch cord exercises, but in a position that mimics the actual swimming body position with laying down rather than standing up, and also having you activate your core through the stability element that comes from being on an inflatable, slightly unstable swim bench, and as well working on a high elbow catch due to the design of the height of the swim bench. The Sen8 Swim Trainer is designed to be used as an adjunct to pool and open water swimming, not meant to replace it, but it can add a greater frequency of stimulus to your swim training by doing some pretty short and effective workouts. And actually, sen8swimtrainer.com recently added a new training page where you can find several of the great workouts that the Sen8 team have developed, all gathered on one page, including one brick workout. So that is a really cool additional feature that is difficult to do, although it can be done in the pool environment if you have special access to the pool, but very difficult to do a swim, bike, brick workout otherwise. But with the Sen8 Swim Trainer, you can do that from the comfort of your own home. You can get 20% off your Sen8 Swim Trainer, which is roughly the price of a pair of good running shoes, on sen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Björn Kafka. Today's guest on That Triathlon Show is Björn Kafka. Björn, good morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you. Fine. Sun is shining, finally, in Munich, so all is good.
Yeah, you're calling in from Munich, where you're located. So other than that, can you give us an introduction to who you are, what your background is in endurance sports, and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I try to. So, of course, as everyone in this field, I think I have an endurance sports background. So mine is cycling, especially road cycling and a bit of cyclocross. I didn't study sports science or biology or something like that. So I studied Scandinavian studies and Islamic studies, due to the fact I was a child of 9/11 things. So when I stopped or when I finished school, 9/11 happened. So I thought that's a good idea to study and understand these kind of things. And I did that and, of course, cycled a lot and did a lot of races and also visit some lectures in sports science. And after I study, I finished my study, so you can go to the kind of secret service or CIA in Germany, become an agent, or you end up in journalism. So I ended up in journalism, which is quite good in Hamburg. And I also did some writing for sports magazines, for a magazine that it's called Bike Magazine. That's the biggest mountain bike magazine in Europe. And so after a few months of working freelance, they gave me an opportunity to work there as an editor. So I did that for some years, 6 years. It became a bit boring, to be honest, because every year you have the same kind of things you're writing about. It's kind of seasonal thing. And I wrote some books things like that. So after 6 years and my first child was born, I thought maybe I should do some other things. And so I started working freelance. And with a friend of mine, I started a small company in endurance sport. He's from Cologne, and he's pretty good in metabolic testing and calculating things. So, and we started to train athletes, and I did that before, also with some quite good races. There was quite a good team in Germany with a lot of talented riders. So I worked there just for fun. And so we had this company. It started in a garage, and that became quite successful. To be honest, we were quite good in coaching and calculating, but very bad in all the other things. So being a CEO of a company that's not my best strength, to be honest. So, and all the things with finance and stuff like that. So we were pretty horrible in that. Forget to send invoices for months and things like that. So, but anyway, the workload became very high. So at a certain point I said, okay, actually I also have a family. So I stopped and I sold my shares, and he continued and is now working at the German Cycling Federation, very successful. And I took a year off. And I started a new company with an old employee. I worked there and trained the coaches there and developed the metabolic calculations that we will talk a little bit later on. And also there I sold my shares because this company is more into the health business, which is absolutely fine. I like more like the professional side. That's why I also teamed up with Aerotune, with Sebastian Schlurke, that I know for quite a while, actually, because we have like our historical background is that we were in the same clubs in Northern Germany. So we met like 25 years ago and listened to a lot of alternative hardcore rock punk music. So that's it. That's me.
Nice. Yeah. And Sebastian Schlurke has been on the podcast before. It was a while ago. And I should have looked it up, but I'm going to Google it now. Which episode was that in? That was episode 90 was Sebastian Schlurke. Okay. So anyway, one thing that, you mentioned there that you did coaching and metabolic testing. One thing you didn't mention that my research tells me is that the coaching that you did, some of it was at a very high level, like having world championship titles and medals, and the European championships and medals and so on. So really, really high level cyclists that you work with in road and mountain bike, cyclocross and track. I think even a 1 hour record, I believe.
Yes.
So
yes.
Is there, so basically, yeah, you've been working with a lot of really high level cyclists. Is there anything you want to give us an example from those merits.
Usually I'm not the guy that is using the megaphone and calling out how successful I am. Maybe sometimes that is not so good, but that's how I am. I like to be a little bit in the background. So currently I'm working with, for example, with one athlete, it's female athlete, her name is Gudrun Stock. She's riding in the pursuit and on the track, and she developed quite nice over the last 2 years from being like a national rider and having some problems, and now is like one of the strong forces in that squad, and they finished third in the last World Championships, and now they are heading to the Olympics in Tokyo, and the goal is to get a medal there, and this is absolutely possible. So, and but my background is a little bit more in mountain biking, and marathon mountain biking, I had quite successful times there, and still have. So, but that's
it. Did you say that you also have coached some triathlon at some point?
Yes, actually more for fun. Some good athletes. Doesn't have any clue about swimming. So always when I coach a triathlete, I always tell them, okay, you need a swim coach. I'm bad in that because it's so much technique in there. You have a very dense water. So everything you do falls in there. So it leads to excessive amounts of energy use. And I don't want to stay beside a pool. And so that's quite boring for me. And running, I love running, but I'm pretty bad in that. But I can calculate these kind of things. And cycling is actually my main thing. And I'm good with that, I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, that sets us up nicely with some context for this discussion. And as you said, we will talk a lot about metabolism and testing and things. But before we get to that, I want to ask a more general question. And based on your testing and coaching experience and your time in endurance sports, can you give examples of what you think are, let's say, the three most common mistakes that endurance athletes tend to make in their training?
Yes, the first thing is eating too little and maybe doing some crazy low-carb things. So this is actually one of the biggest problems, especially if something is kind of trendy. And maybe the trend is like going backwards a little bit from low-carb. I'm happy with that because I saw a lot of athletes kind of falling apart. Also, high-level athletes. You always have to keep in mind that maybe high-level athletes are not really into sports science. They don't have a clue. They are very talented, and they did a lot of things right because maybe they had some good coaches and they have like a good gut feeling. But so eating too little or eating too much low-carb will lead to not the best performance in the world. And so in brief parts of time, it can be useful, but most of the time, just eating. And the other thing is working on the weak link. So what's in triathlon, we have a lot of things we can work on now. So maybe you have a bad running technique. You actually should work on that. Everyone has a tendency to work on things that they like. Of course, I like riding VO2 max intervals because I, for example, have a high glycolytic power. I can do that a lot. Starting with, for example, if you take running, starting with like learning new running technique takes time and it's boring. You do like half an hour and it's like, oh, yeah, I want to do 20 miles or something like that and not like jogging for 45 minutes on the ground and doing some high cadence things and like that. So working on the weak link, I think it's one of the things everyone should look on. And the other thing is, I see that with in triathlon, we would call them age groupers, the right life stress balance. This is in high level professional athletes. This aspect always comes when there are children involved. So you have to get that around your training to have like the right stress balance. And So being like, if you have like if you want to achieve something, people think they have to work very individualized and being kind of egoistic. But on one hand, that will lead to a lot of stress with family, and this is not beneficial. So having a good life balance, it sounds very simple, but I see that even in high level athletes, if you have problem with your partner, this will end up not well. And the partner usually doesn't love you because you are a high level athlete. They usually marry you because you're a nice person and not what because you're a world champion in triathlon or on the track or on the road. Yeah. Always keep that in mind.
Yeah. Those are all really, really great, great things to think about. Now, if we get into the metabolic side of things, and this was actually the reason I first contacted you and we started talking, because you were on the Endurance Innovation podcast and you said you had some interesting discussions there. One thing that stood out to me was how you mentioned that the VO2 max of an athlete can be used to back calculate roughly how much training load they should take on in terms of kilojoules, for example, or you can convert that to hours of training. So so that was the first thing that I reached out to you about. And perhaps we can start to discuss that as the first question. So can you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, so actually you have the VO2 max in milliliters, and you can calculate the kilojoules you're using to produce this VO2 max, or you can actually measure it when you have a spirometry and stuff like that. And so the theory behind this is it's developed by Marder and Alois Marder, the professor. And so you take a fraction out of that and to get the best growth. Yeah. And it's about protein synthesis and stuff like that. So a little bit more complicated, but to make it easier. So you take a fraction out of that, a percentage out of the VO2 max, you could maybe use in a like lab environment on a cellular level. So for 24 hours, take a fraction out of that, and that's your kilojoules you can use per day to get the best adaptation. So all these adaptation processes are, if you look back in time, from the German biologist Wilhelm Rusch, who described this kind of growth in the 19th century. And so that's actually it. And this is a nice way to calculate because you, especially if you do zone 2 training, base training, you see if someone is overreaching or not. But always keep in perspective that this guy is eating enough or this athlete is eating enough and having a nice balanced life. Otherwise, too much stress will lead to other things. So this is only like on a cellular level. So what to do, what you have to do to get the best benefit, and what's the minimum you have to do. But to be honest, on the minimum, you always have to take into account we all are born with a different genetic makeup. So I a few days ago, sorry to say that. Maybe I hope I will not end up in jail. I tested my son. He's 9 years old, just for fun. So I designed a RAM test for children. And there's a study I looked it up because I was curious and calculated it and thought, okay, maybe that's 40 VO2 max. Oh, that's not too high. So I think my son is more talented. No, to be honest, I'm not that kind of a parent. And so I calculated that thing and I looked it up and saw, okay, they did tests and they start with 3-year-old children up to like when they 14, 15, 16, 18 years old and how the VO2 max is developing. And you have a big discrepancy because some start at very low levels and some children are already very high. So that's your makeup. And so what's the minimum to hold that makeup? Some people hardly do anything and they still have this gift. There's this famous anecdote about Oskar Svensson, this Norwegian cyclist who already had like 70 VO2 max, was hardly doing anything. Yeah. So these freaks exist. And of course, a certain amount of energy you have to use to maintain the respiration of your mitochondria and develop a VO2 max and, of course, stroke volume and all these kind of things. You actually can calculate a minimum.
Yeah. So the basic theory is something along the lines of that if you do too much work as a percentage of what you theoretically can do at your VO2 max, then the protein synthesis process won't be able to keep up, so to say, if you put it in layperson's terms.
Yes.
And then you won't see adaptation, or you'll see maladaptation.
Yes. So
can you
in a training camp, of course, you always have like an overreaching. But then the nice thing is you can calculate how long it takes to recover from that. So that's because everyone is overreaching at some certain points. That's part of the process. Yeah. So this is a handy tool to use. Yeah. Sorry.
Can you give some examples of if you like just roughly, if you don't have numbers in front of you, but if we have an athlete that has a VO2 max of 45 or 60 or 75, and they do base training mostly. Roughly how many hours we'd end up being sort of their recommended maximum?
Always depends on the Vela max, of course. Sorry, I use my calculator. Wait a second. So, for example, we have someone. I can do it by heart. So if you have someone who was like 70 VO2 max and... so he should train about 2.5 hours and doing, for example, 2,300 kilojoules a day, and take that by multiply that by 7, and then you have the kilojoules. So it's 14,000. This is a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and then you see, okay, I am at in base training. So what's my power output there? And then you calculate that, and then you get a certain number out of that. So maybe I don't know. 16 hours, and then you have roughly 16 hours. But always look at the kilojoules, because who is riding this power output constantly? No one.
Yeah.
And doing that indoor has some other problems, because you overheat and stuff like that. So usually if you say 16, maybe it's like 18 or 19.
Looking at... Yeah, I created a table based on our discussion that we had earlier.
Ah, very good.
And I'm looking here at somebody with a VO2 max of 70 and get the, depending on slightly what the fraction is, but a kilojoule range of 12 to 14 or 15,000 kilojoules.
Yes.
And then if we can, let's say that the average that they're at 70, maybe they're riding at 210 watts average. That would be 750 kilojoules per hour. I plug that into my little calculator, and then we get, 15 to 18 hours or so.
I was quite good by heart.
So I mean, just to give the listeners here, if we have somebody on the other hand who has a VO2 max of 60 and their average power is 180 watts, then we get something more like around 13 to 16 hours or so.
Yeah.
And if we have somebody with a VO2 max of, let's say, 45 and their average power is 140 watts, then we end up having, then the maximum that they should be doing is more like in the 11 to 15 hours, but that, so the hours don't change that much, but that's of course because the power I've changed the power numbers here from 210 to 140 watts average. But if you actually look at the kilojoules, then this 45 kilojoule athlete would do 6,500 to 8,000 kilojoules a week.
Yes.
And the 70 VO2 max athlete would be doing up to 14 or 15,000 kilojoules. So it's a very big difference there.
So, and if you have someone with a low VO2 max and a very low Vela max, so they are able to ride quite fast in zone 2, they hardly train.
Yeah, yeah.
But they go quite fast.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing that I want to discuss around VO2 max with you is based on your calculations and your testing, what do you think about, is it possible to assess whether an athlete is limited, more limited centrally or peripherally, so in their cardiovascular system or in their muscles when it comes to VO2 max?
Oh, yeah, that's actually a quite complicated question. No, I would always say, as a coach, you always have to look at the athlete and see how he responds. If you do, for example, if you do a lab test and with a mask on and you see that there's the oxygen they consume, or you also have like a pulse oximeter on the finger and you see you have certain kind of drops, they are getting too low in oxygen saturation. Maybe you have a problem with like pulmonary diffusion in the lungs, so that the blood flow is too high and we don't get enough air into the blood and O2 into the blood, and so we have a problem there. So you can measure that in the lab. This is one thing I'm always looking at with high level athletes, because it's this problem. I see that not often, but at some athletes, you see that, and then you have to send them to a special lab. But you have to explain the special lab what they should look on, because this in normal humans, you don't see that so much, so often. So this is one thing. And another thing is, how good is there, if you talk about the central, heart rate recovery? If you go hard, how long does it take to drop? And how high is the percentage? Yeah, always keep in mind that you have to reach a very high level, a very high heart rate. Yeah, and then you want to see quite a substantial drop. If you have not a very high heart rate because you are overreaching, and then of course you have a low drop. This is kind of a symptom for overreaching. I think Lemaire showed that quite nicely in a study. And so heart rate recovery, I always look at that. Yeah,
and what does heart rate recovery tell you if you have a good, fast, and big heart rate recovery versus if you don't have that?
Yeah, that you have a quite good stroke volume, and this athlete recovers quite fast from exertion. If someone has like 190 and drops like 60 beats in a minute or 65, you have like an metabolic monster in front of you. And if this takes time, and then this guy is maybe not so fit. This is only like rough estimation.
Yeah, of course.
And then you have other things like, maybe you see, in a lab there's also some drops in O2 usage. Maybe there's some problem with the blood supply to the muscles. You can use an Moxie, for example, or a NIRS technique to examine that, look at the left leg and the right leg, and you see maybe there are some certain drops. And most of the times the athletes tell you that. It's more like, I feel like at threshold, or if I do high torque, sweet spot stuff, that my left leg feels kind of numb and things like that. So, So I switched that off. Sorry, that was my mother. You have to look at that. And this is one of the other limiters I see often, or not often, but sometimes in athletes, yes.
Yeah. How important do you think, is it important or to know whether you're limited centrally or peripherally, or are many athletes kind of balanced, so it doesn't really matter? How much do you use that in your coaching?
Most of the time, if you work with high level athletes, the central part is not so often limited. You look for other things, maybe do a blood check and look how's the B12, the ferritin. Always keep in mind with ethnic backgrounds do these people have, because they always have like different makeups and bloods. Yeah, if you work with a high level Kenyan runner, you see this is HB level, it's not too high, But you always have to look, keep that in mind. But a blood check is always look for the link, a weak link there, especially if you send someone to a high altitude training camp. So actually,
yeah,
it's if you work with athletes that do not train so much, the cardiac output always go. The volume, cardiac output. So these are the first things you should work on. But hey, high level athletes, I look at other things.
And with regard to improving cardiac output for normal athletes, normal amateurs, what sort of a high level training strategy to approach that?
Go long and go hard sometimes.
Yeah,
pretty simple.
Yeah,
and look at your resting heart rate. That's a nice kind of an indicator of your stroke volume. If you see that over a year is going lower, then you have nice adaptations. And if you have a huge range of like from low to high, if you have someone with like, for example, 38 resting heart rate and 201 max, he's quite fit. Always look at the resting heart rate. It's quite a nice indicator.
Awesome. Now let's discuss VLA max, so the maximum glycolytic capacity, a little bit. And first, this is something we have talked about several times on the podcast before. So we don't need to make a like really detailed explanation, perhaps, because most listeners will be familiar. But can you do a brief overview of what VLA max is, and then how it impacts performance as well, depending on what it is like, whether it's high or low or moderate?
Yes, of course. So always when we do VLA max. It's often called the glycolytic power. So always when we use glucose, we always have we have the breakdown, we have lactate and pyruvate. And so due to the level of lactate measured in millimole per second, we have the VLA max. So the VLA max tells us how much carbs we use for a certain power output. And the other thing is maybe to say it in kind of an easy words, how is your ability to maybe sprint, explosive power and stuff like that. So, to take it in easy words. So I used it in the other podcast, this analogy of, Usain Bolt sitting on a tandem. And, so you have a high power output there, with Usain Bolt, but Usain Bolt always needs to eat the whole time. And he needs, of course, a long time to recover after a short burst of power. So he's constantly eating your bars from your pockets. And because you're the VO2 max in this kind of analogy. And so that's VLA max. Yeah. It's your power, so to say. Yeah. But also your limiter, because VLA max needs a lot of carbohydrates.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you have a Usain Bolt sitting there behind you, then that's good when you get to the sprint finish. But when you're on a long Alpe d'Huez climb, then you kind of need to carry him, and he just eats your gels out of your pocket. So then it can be a negative thing to have that Usain Bolt there. So that was a nice analogy. And so we have talked before in interviews with, for example, Sebastian Weber about how to test and assess VO2 max and VLA max and what it might mean. But one thing that you also mentioned in the Endurance Innovation podcast is that the really tricky thing and like important thing, of course, is to like knowing how to actually use, like if you do a test and you get your VO2 max and VLA max values, like knowing how to really use those values in training. So can you discuss that a bit more?
Yes. So actually, this is one of the main purposes why we developed this tool and also the Aerotune power test, also to show the people what is maybe the best training, which kind of intensities are beneficial and which not. Because now we have this VLA max, is a term that is quite German, to be honest. Yeah. So it's Marder started with that in the late 70s, I think. So it's more like, if you look at the historical background, so it's more like a quite German thing. And now it becomes more like fancy because Sebastian Weber, who's doing a great job and informs a lot of people about that. And everyone knows, okay, now we have the Vela Max. But the next thing is what to do about that. And this is, only knowing what it is actually half the truth. You really need to know how to work with that. And what is the purpose? What do you want to achieve in long term and in short term in your sport? Yeah. If you have a cyclist who wants to compete in sprint racing on the track, you have to work on his VeloMax that is going up. Yeah. If you have someone who's doing like classic spring races, you have to look, okay, it has to be balanced, maybe 0.45 or 0.5, so that he's able to do short bursts of sprinting and attacking to catch a group. And triathlon, long distance, you have to maybe in the short term, or if you want to go to a race, it has to be low. Of course, it has to be low. But is it always clever to be very low all the time to develop certain kind of system? No, of course not. Yeah. So you have to play, or play is maybe not the right word. You have to use VeloMax to get the adaptations you want. Yeah. So if you want to develop the VO2 max, maybe it's more useful to work on work with a higher VeloMax for a certain time.
Yeah, because if you have a very low VLA max, then you're super limited in the amount of training you can do above threshold, and then it's difficult to also develop the VO2 max. So you might want a bit more of a buffer to allow you to do enough work to improve VO2 max, and then later when you get closer to a race, you can start to lower VLA max again. But for a triathlete, if we're talking numbers, what would be some typical values, long distance triathlon, like half and full distance? What would you say would be good sort of target ranges for VLA max to be for a triathlete?
0.35, sorry. Yep. And going down to maybe 0.2. something. So if you long distance, so this would be good.
Is there a difference in VLA max between males and females normally?
I've seen it especially after females gave birth. So it's quite fun. The VLA max was quite low. The big difference, maybe I haven't seen so many numbers. So I also have, if you look at a track cyclist, a women's track cyclist, they still have like high VeloMax numbers. So, usually you see, maybe that's because of, we test more males. You have the males usually have more, a higher VeloMax. Yes. See that.
That's what I've seen as well in my coaching. What else? So, I mean, I think it would be interesting to discuss a little bit around what you mentioned there with the historical background and VLA max being a very German thing. Can you maybe elaborate a bit on that? And like, what is, like, how is it established? Is it proven? And if it is, why hasn't it been more widely used in other parts of the world?
Is it proven? Actually, we can discuss it for some hours. Take it more like a theoretical estimation of your glycolytic power. Of course, you can do a test, a 15-second sprint test, take lactate and calculate then. So this is one part. And if you look more like the historical background. So Alois Mader, who was in East Germany, was fleeing. I'm not sure. West Germany,
fugitive.
Fugitive to West Germany. Worked there in Cologne. And if you read his book, Die Kiamere des Dopings und die Irrealität der Trainingswissenschaft, which would be something like a Chimera of Doping and the Unreality of Sports Science. And you see, he was not very popular in Germany. So maybe that took it took quite a while to establish the Wheeler Max calculation. So, and Sebastian Weber was, in my knowledge, and the first one who more like opened it up for sports science, and he used it in to calculate, and he was quite successful. Yeah, and he was very successful. Yeah, and if you look at the early 2000s, when he started with, I think it was HTC Columbia and things like that, he produced some world class time trial lists with his calculations. So that's the first thing, and the other thing is because you can't really measure it, and it's most of the stuff is in German. You hardly find any things in English. So we start now with that, and there's a lot of mathematical calculations behind that, and going from ATP, AMP, and stuff like that. And so it takes some time to understand that. Some people are maybe afraid. It's not straightforward. It's not like VO2 max. Putting on, measuring it, then we are fine. And VO2 max always have like this historical advantage. A.V. Hill started like in 1920, something like that. And they developed a RAM test in 1927 or something like that. So and this is well established. Maybe it's like an historical thing. Yeah. So that's my assumption. Yeah. And So.
Yeah. No, it's good. The way I look at it is sort of, it is biochemistry and biochemical reactions that are very sort of like we know what happens and it can be calculated, it can be simulated. So in that sense, it is it is like I guess the difference between. It works, but it's something that is difficult to measure. It's the same thing with a lot of the things we have had in physics. Like you have a lot of physical theories, but then it takes some time to actually be able to measure them, and that's why. And it takes like billions and billions of dollars to build like linear hidden LHCs and stuff like that, and like kilometers and kilometers of tunnels under CERN to prove some things, and maybe we're not quite there yet where we can actually measure it directly, but that doesn't mean that the theory underlying it is incorrect, because on a cellular level the biochemical reactions are quite established. So yeah, I guess it depends on how you define proven, but it's something that's useful. It's like somebody said all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I think that this is a useful model.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, there are some high level coaches who don't use it, and a lot, to be honest, and they are successful. So it's a nice way to know, but it doesn't mean that you need to know it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, because you can. I've had that situation where some of my athletes I do test with like Insight, for example, and have used VLA max and VO2 max and everything, and some other I haven't for whatever reason, and I haven't really necessarily seen always that it makes a difference, because you can still, if you get to know the athlete, you can still see their sort of overall profile, and you can make some guesses, and even with some coaches that might not at least like in the old days, like class old school coaches that maybe aren't great with physiology, but they are super knowledgeable about actual coaching and anecdotal knowledge. It's just about knowing the athlete and having a really good gut feeling and a really good intuition. And that's another great way of coaching if you're really, really good in that way. So there are many, many ways to skin a cat.
Yes.
So about VLA max, now that it is becoming more popular, as you said, now it's getting out there in the media. Also, I remember that Jan Olbrecht, the Belgian swim coach, he did write about it in his book, Science of Win.
Science of Win, great book.
Yeah. But now that we've had it for a few years, do you hear any common sort of myths or misconceptions about it that you would like to explain or correct?
No, the most things that concern me is that people are using it to more like an if a coach has it and use it more like a marketing tool. Now I know I have Vela Max and I know everything. This is not true. There's no myth behind it. Yeah, and because maybe I'm like shut my eyes from that and not looking so much left and right. Maybe that's why. And but the thing that concerns me is like I have this, someone saying I have this numbers and number and I know everything. So this is actually the thing that concerns me. So I don't know. Do you have any myth you can think of?
I think we discussed one already, that lower is always better. That's one I think is quite common. And that's actually something that I want to ask you about as well, because I think Jan Olbrecht mentioned that in his book, that if you have a very low VLA max, you also run a higher risk of overtraining. Is that something that you can comment on?
Maybe if you have like a highly trained athlete, and imagine like 75 VO2 max, and with like a 0.3 or 2.5 VLA max. So that athlete needs a lot of energy flux per week. And due to the fact that his zone 2 training is at a quite high speed, he still needs a lot of carbohydrates. Yeah, even at these, even if that he is so efficient, so that can lead to under eating, and you have problems with the protein synthesis in this area. So this is what I see. If you are very efficient and you have like quite a big engine, VO2 max, so to say, this can lead to overtraining, overreaching. So this is what I see.
How is VLA max? If you have a higher VLA max and you have the same VO2 max, then are you saying that because then you're theoretically using more carbohydrate, but maybe you're going slower in your easy training? Is that the difference, or what is the role of VLA max there in the risk of overtraining?
If you have a low VLA max, your pyruvate deficit is quite high, so you're using a lot of fatty acids, and you have the highest lactate use and stuff like that. And if, for example, let's make up an athlete, 72 VO2 max and 0.3 VLA max. So this guy maybe rides his zone 2 or fat max training at a power output of 300 watts, which is quite substantial. So he's quite fast. But he uses a lot of energy, even from carbohydrates. So he actually needs to eat, for example, like 45, or depends on his body weight and stuff like that, maybe 50 grams of carbohydrates. A lot of athletes are not doing that. You have to teach them to eat. So this is what I see. And because of his high VO2 max, he's doing like 22 hours of training and always going quite fast. So they start to undereat. And the limit at some point is, of course, a digestive system and things like that. So you need to eat and think, yeah.
But if this athlete has a VLA max instead of 0.3 of 0.5,
yes.
What is the difference? What is the difference?
They go slower.
Okay.
They go slower. Yes. Yeah. Of course, they have to eat more. They constantly eat. Usually they go slower.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes sense. But then,
yes.
I think a caveat here is that they go slower if the coach tells them to go slower.
Yes.
Because they might not automatically do that if they're left to their own devices.
Yes. Oh, this is quite hard for some of the athletes. If they have 0.7, you say to them, okay, you have to go at 180 watts. They are like, oh, come on, beyond this boring. But you have to. Sorry.
One thing that I want to ask about as well is your thoughts around VLA max in running and swimming. Is it like how can we use that when we compare it to cycling and perhaps train and and get adaptations in running and cycling.
Yes. So
running and swimming, I said. I mean,
yeah. I'm not a swim coach, so I don't have much. Yeah, I don't know much about that. So of course I read the books from Olbrich and did some things in swimming, but if I train athletes, triathletes, yeah, I always tell them get a coach and learn the technique. And I think this is also in running. There's some truth in that. Yeah. Look at the running economy. And I think this is actually, for me, it is more important than the Vela Max. Yeah. And of course, I can measure the Vela Max in running and calculate that. And sometimes, oh, you have like a low Vela Max and you think, okay, this guy is able to run like 2 hour, 40 minutes in a marathon, but he isn't. Why? So you have to look at the running economy. And if you keep in mind, I always have this picture in mind, looking at Geoffrey Kamara winning the New York Marathon. So at kilometer 20 or 30, all the runners look good. But at kilometer 35, only one guy looked good, and that was Geoffrey Kamara, because he had like the perfect running style and the economy. So we are living, they are moving in a free space. Yeah. So, and if they lose energy because of they do some funny movements or the elasticity of their tendons are getting, are not so good. It's not so good anymore. They lose running economy, and it's even worse in swimming. So think like a pyramid, yeah, in swimming, technique. In running, also technique, and then Vela Max, we can talk about that. And in cycling, because we are like on a fixed bike, it's easier. Yeah? You're not talking so much about technique. Of course, we also have the discussions. Yeah, if you push quite hard and the saddle is not wide enough for you and your seat bones are slipping over the saddle, you of course lose energy. Yeah. And so getting maybe a bigger saddle and to prevent this loss of energy, this can help a lot. But these are like, compared to running, these are minor things. Yeah. So I always look at the economy. And then you have nice measurement tools like a Stride, who can tell you some truth about the economy. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense that in the hierarchy of needs in swimming and running, it is much lower than the economy and also how sustainable the economy is. So what is your economy when you start the marathon on an Ironman, like, which is even different than just a marathon
yes.
in itself.
Yes.
And
yes.
And then at the end of that marathon as well. So yeah, that makes very good sense. One thing I want to get to as well in terms of cycling training is how you use cadence and torque. Of course, it's something we've heard a lot about in terms of VLA max training, but you might have some other tips and suggestions for using cadence and torque as well. So feel free to discuss that topic generally and how you recommend using cadence and torque in training.
Yes. In cycling, for example, if you when I think about I think it was Flèche Wallonne, the race. If you look at the women's race, it was quite interesting to see because I think it was Annika van der Breggen who won. They were constantly riding in a very, very high gear. And it was interesting because if you're riding in a high gear, you, of course, save the fast twitch fibers. But she was actually doing that on the last climb. So she was winning kind of the race with a very high cadence, which is... I don't know. Maybe it's more like I saw that in the top level women's riders, so which was quite interesting. So no one was pushing a big gear. In men's racing, you still see that a lot of torque is used, and of course you can't sustain that for a long stage race, yeah, because you're getting tired. But sorry for that. We come back. Do I use cadence and especially torque and training? Yes, of course. And how do I use it? If I want to lower the Vela Max, I use that because, for example, at sweet spot intensity. Yeah, well, the idea is to use more like fast twitch fibers, FTA, to make them weak and becoming more like the slow twitch fibers. So that's the idea. And if you want to make it easy, you can calculate which torque do you have at, for example, VO2 max when I do like 95 cadence. So, and can I implement that kind of torque in base training? Yeah. And then you see, okay, reverse calculate that and see, okay, if I do like 55 or 50 cadence, I have the same torque. And of course I lose, I use less oxygen because lower cadence uses less oxygen. And then you hope to be honest, you hope
and lower that power
you,
as well.
Yes. Yes. You hope that you fatigue the muscles you want to. Yeah. So this is how I use it. And of course in cycling, in men's cycling, if someone is attacking, you must be able to use high torque. Yeah. And to, especially in mountain biking. Yeah. You need high torque and we train that. And it gives you some economy in cycling. If you are able to push 400 watts with 60 cadence with a big gear and your knee lining is quite straight, you know, you don't lose power. So, and you can work with that. Yeah. In strength training and in a gym or at low cadence. In training. Yeah.
And for those that don't like to calculate things, then this is actually pretty easy. You can just put a torque field on your Garmin computer.
Yes. It's
pretty easy. So when you mentioned there that you can, that you would, for example, compare the torque at 90 to 95 RPM at VO2 max with what, and then calculate, okay, so what cadence do I need to do at sweet spot or even base training? Do you think that a good reference point when you want to target those fast twitch, the FTA fibers, is that sort of VO2 max intensity? Like that's sort of the torque, the same torque that you want to replicate, or do you sometimes go lower, like to your typical threshold torque, or what's your take on that?
It depends on the Vila max, yeah. If I have like someone with a high glycolytic power, so to say a high Vila max, I know that he's using more fast twitch fiber, so we can go a little bit lower. Look at the maximum lactate steady state compared to the VO2 max at a high glycolytic guy. You see there's a big gap. And if you have someone with a low, you see they are quite closely. So I use torque with a high glycolytic guys, and I want to lower that. I necessarily don't use the VO2 max. Maybe I go lower. So this is how I use it.
That makes perfect sense. Then some other, moving into the part of the interview where we're having some general training questions. And then my next question is about intensity. What's like your general opinion around how to include intensity in a training plan, in terms of, for example, like how much can you do? How sustainable is it? And just your general thoughts around intensity.
Intensity is important. So of course we know that. Yeah, if you want to develop a good stroke volume, intensity is necessary. But if we talk about intensity, a lot of people think about maybe heart rate. So actually, this is actually what I like a little bit more, and wattage power output. But the problem is if you go to a lab and you have your maybe 400 watts at VO2 max. It's not like you're going out and you're riding 400 watts and then you are at your VO2 max. No. This takes time. Yeah. Maybe 4 minutes to reach that. Or maybe you do a sprint before that and then you do riding at maximal lactate steady state to reach your VO2 max. So, you have to do certain kind of intervals, maybe 40-20 or 30-30, and to reach your VO2 max for a longer time because of the fast and slow component. As we know, for example, if you take a low glycolytic guy, 0.2. He is usually quite faster at the VO2 max, or he is faster, and the high glycolytic guy takes some time, so he needs longer intervals in that. Yeah, or maybe you do like the Bilat intervals are quite famous with that, and or maybe you do some other things like sprinting out and try to sustain the power for 3 minutes. This also works. So intensity is important, especially if you want to develop the VO2 max. But this is maybe if we always talk about the VO2 max, you have to go hard. Yeah. So going at threshold and start with threshold, you usually doesn't lead to the high VO2 max areas where you want to end up. Yeah. If you start with a sprint maybe and then go to a threshold power, then it can elicit the VO2 max and the certain power you want, or the certain oxygen consumption. So this is actually the things that Steven Seiler talked about. Yeah, this black hole training, going at threshold and sweet spot and hope for a high VO2 max is not working. So he developed this kind of polarized approach, which is quite nice. But it's not, if we have this nice measurement of power, but we always have to keep in mind power doesn't equals VO2 max use. It equals VO2 max use in the lab. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So, but not in real time. You need some time to get your VO2 max up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is my point. Yeah.
Yeah. How many times a week would you have somebody do high intensity if they are in a block where they're developing VO2 max, and for how long would that block last? How many weeks?
2 to 3 weeks, 3 times a week.
All right. Yeah.
And it's quite hard.
Yeah.
And you always have the athletes have the tendency to ride like in a, they don't want to hurt so much. Yeah. And or they hurt themselves very hard and then rest for some time. So you always accumulate stress. You always have to keep that in mind. You always have to tell that you're athlete. So you're working and it's quite hard, and you accumulate stress for a certain amount of time, for example, 2 or 3 weeks. So maybe the first session feels okay, it's manageable. The second one is harder. And maybe the third one you do like 2 days later is maybe he's fresher, but it's even harder. Yeah. So over 3 weeks time, the last one is very hard and they are fatigued. Yeah. So, but I do 3 times and 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because then we have the fastest adaptations.
Yeah. And if you could give just one workout that a low glycolytic athlete that you would recommend for a low glycolytic athlete, just as an example for the listeners, and one workout that you would recommend for a high glycolytic athlete. Can you give those two examples?
Always depends on, I'm sorry for that, always depends.
No problem.
Low glycolytic, I would do like 1.5 minutes of, or maybe 2 minutes at VO2 max power, and then switching to Vela max, maximal lactate steady state power output for about 7, 8, 9 minutes, and do that 3 times, maybe 4 times.
Yeah.
With a high glycolytic, so if I talk, for example, I have a high, maybe professional athletes, he's doing like 5 times 7 minutes, 40-20.
Yep.
So this works quite fast. But both of the systems works. And of course, the closer the race is, the harder you go. Yeah. You can even use runner start intervals like 30-15. Yeah. But I use it not like to develop the capacity. Yeah. It's more like to develop the specific demands of a race. I like the 30-15s for like, because it's very hard and the athlete has to suffer. So I use it more like a peak, not to develop the capacity, the VO2 max, because no one sustained that for 3 weeks and doing it 3 times a week. And no one likes that.
Yeah. Next question, nutrition in training and racing. What are your recommendations for that? We already heard some you should eat, but can you elaborate a bit?
Yeah, always eat carbs. And if you do the calculations, for example, with AeroTune, you always see how much carbs you use. And of course, it's a calculation. You sometimes use more, you sometimes use less. So always eat. You get better adaptations. You don't get sick. You're not so tired. You don't have brain fog and things like that. Wow. And you can be a kind of a normal person. Yeah. You don't need like fancy stuff. Yeah. So buy a 5 kilos of maltodextrin and use it for training. Putting in, I don't know, 40, 50 grams, depending on your Vela max and your VO2 max, how much you use during zone 2 training. And then go riding. Yeah? And after training, also eat so that you don't get sick. But if you want to, for example, lose weight, you always need a deficiency in calories. So you can calculate that. And maybe you go with 300 or maybe 500, depending on your body weight, of course. And if you go low carb, only for a short time. Now, if you want to, like the quick fix of Vela Max, under eat in training and go maybe low carb. Yeah, that's actually it. And I also recommend eating in training because, as we all know, if you don't eat in training and you're going 4 hours and you hardly have eaten anything, you start fantasizing about what you want to eat when you're at home. And when you're at home, you open up the refrigerator, or maybe even worse, you don't have anything at home. You go to a supermarket. So the first thing you do, you grab the Haribos and you're eating 200 grams of Haribos, which maybe end up in overeating, and you gain weight even that you trained, and your Vela Max is not adapting the way you want. So I have seen riders who are not eating in training, eating a lot after training. So Haribos, 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 sugary stuff, and nothing happened at their Vela Max.
Yep.
No adaptation on the VO2 Max, no adaptation on the Vela Max. So it was training for the garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A great summary. What do you say to people with that would argue that, well, if I eat carbs in training consistently, then my fat oxidation will suffer, or I will be carb dependent, and I'm an Ironman athlete, and I need to be able to oxidize fat effectively? What would you say to that?
No. You always oxidize both of them. Yeah. So if, of course, there's a nice study. I don't know from whom. I have to look it up. Maybe you go, you started and on an empty stomach, you start a workout in the morning without eating anything, maybe a coffee. And after 30 minutes, you start eating some carbohydrates in training. There's hardly any change in fat oxidization. So I have to look it up, the study, and I will send it to you.
Yep.
Or maybe it was a PhD work. I'm not sure about that. No, I wouldn't. So this argue, you can, if you show them the study, this argued it's not working. But of course, if you should not eat like 30 minutes before your training, because your blood level is, your blood sugar level, insulin is quite high. So don't do that. And also not like this famous stop at the gas station and eating a lot of stuff and half a liter of Coca-Cola. This will also make you go up and down the blood sugar. And also with like fructose, you have to be a little bit careful not to eating too much, because this also has some kind of influences on your blood sugar, even in intensity, during intensity. I would go easy, buy some maltodextrin, play around with that, how much you can eat of that without getting any problems. And in racing, of course, try to eat as much as possible that is that you can handle. And the problem is, if you are not used to eat a lot of carbs during training, you're not able to digest all these carbs in racing. So the bacteria and all these kind of things need to be trained with it. So if you go hardcore low carb, you maybe lose the ability to digest carbs in a good way. So maybe you're only able to digest 60 grams an hour, which is nothing. Even with a low Vila Max, you're like, yeah. So, and maybe you can digest 120 grams.
Yeah.
And that even doesn't mean that even isn't related how big or if you're male or female or whatever. I've seen a study that was quite, so they compared how much they can like digest. And use it for power output, and was like a female athlete, or I think it was a triathlete, with 55 kilos, she could use 120 grams of carbohydrates per hour. But yeah, she was used to that. So in pro-level cycling, so what are we doing? So of course, maybe we go low carb, but before we go to racing, we start with high carbohydrate intake during training. So that they get used to that, especially fructose and stuff like that. So and everyone can do that. Yeah. By, as I said, maltodextrin, different kinds. So maybe D6, D19. So the fast and the slow ones based on the molecular level, mixing in some, fructose. And then you will see how you feel.
Yeah.
Train that.
I think in the last few years, things have really shifted in terms of what we look at as like adequate nutrition for things like stage races and long distance triathlon. And it used to be like 60 grams is pretty good, but now you say 60 grams is nothing. And I agree with you. Like it's when we're talking about these kinds of endurance events, then like basically now we're looking at 90 grams as kind of a minimum, but we're hoping to get up to 100, 110, 120 grams. And you sent me an example of your Aerotune power test report, and you actually have a nice chart there that shows your power theoretical power duration curve. So how much power you can produce for different durations, let's say 2 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, depending on how much carbs you're consuming. And the difference there between 120 grams and 60 grams is really, really big when you get to that 4 hour mark, for example.
Yes. Yeah. And if you talk about triathlon nutrition, of course, on the bike, you need to eat as much as possible. Maybe 120 grams because we can digest it, because it's easier to digest because of two reasons. First, we use less muscle mass. So we have more blood in our digestive system, and we don't have this up and down oscillation problem. And if your stomach is full and you're getting up and down, so maybe you get some problems with digestion. So fuel up during the bike ride, and then on the run, see what you can handle, maybe 60, maybe 70 grams. And there are some companies one company who designed this kind of jelly thing for running. So maybe this works.
Next question. Is there some particular area within endurance sports or sports science, physiology, that you're currently researching a lot, that you're fascinated by, interested in generally? And can you just explain what you might be interested in at the moment?
Actually, it's adaptation and trainability. So this is a very fascinating topic, and I love it, and I already played around with it and modeling a lot of things. So me and Sebastian Schlurike the man who invented Aerotune, based on your age, your VO2 max, your Vela max, and what are you able to achieve? So, and there are some studies, and you find some very weird things about fishes swimming in circles, young fishes, old fishes, and like mid-aged fishes. And there are some, from an anecdotal perspective, you see, oh, yeah, that is. If I train a very young athlete, which I like to do, to develop young athletes and see if they end up in some kind of national team or maybe world tour or something like that, you see, okay, they can go very hard, but only for 1 week, maybe 2 weeks. And then you have to be, you have to take back. And then maybe if you have someone who's quite established and very good, he can do everything. And with the older one, you have to start a little bit slower, but they can sustain quite long. So this is what me and Sebastian are doing now, to see if you can model, first of all, the development of VO2 max, if that is possible. So we have like numbers from 3 year old, and we have this nice study from this guy who is 104 year old. I think it's also done by Veronique Bilar.
Yep.
The VO2 max test. So maybe we can fit some curves, and we have some other curves. So maybe you can create something out of that. So that's what I love to do. And of course, trainability. Yeah. Based on that, and based on the numbers we get from cadence, power output, and then torque, heart rate, and calculate the carbs we used, and maybe getting out the phosphates we're using. So making a nice model to calculate adaptation. So I started with that like 5 years ago and developed young athletes. So how much intensity they should work on and how much volume they should do. And then getting the data and seeing how's the stress level. Yeah. So how much time do they need to rest? And this is what I already have. But the idea is to also implement that on AeroTune. This will take some time, of course. And this is what I really love. So development of athletes.
That
what's possible.
That is so cool. Do you have any sort of anecdotal or practical takeaways that the listeners can already from the work that you have been doing in that area that they can take as a tip and maybe help them in their training and development?
I think you always hear that from coaches. Work in a constant way. This is the key. So you don't sprint a marathon. You just go slow, but don't stop half the way. So what we usually see is like everyone can work for 6 weeks in a kind of concentrated way, and then they just fall apart, and they just say, "Okay, I don't do anything for 2 weeks because I've trained 6 weeks." But that we lose so much adaptation. Yeah. Maybe do a little less, and also like season breaks. I'm not a big fan of that. Yeah. So the longest season break my athletes use is 2 weeks, not more. And then we start with some other work. Of course, they don't want to be they don't want to start cycling again and going long. And so we do other things like ski mountaineering, running, I don't know, stand up paddling, whatever. But don't go too long. So especially in high level athletes, we see if they stop for 2 weeks, we lose, due to stroke volume and all these other things, we lose quite substantial power at VO2 max. So don't go too long. And this is what I always recommend.
Yeah.
Structured, maybe doing only 80% of that, but in the long term, you will achieve more than going always 100% and fall apart after 6 weeks.
Yeah. Well, this is something I talk about like a couple of times per month, at least on this podcast. But I think that it's very common that athletes look at how much they're training on a given week, but they look at their best week. So, I trained 12 hours this week. It's pretty good. My training volume is 12 hours. But then when you actually look at the entire year, and you average out, so how much training did I do on average in the year, and it was 7 hours, then like that's what you should be looking at, how much did you do on the like long time scale rather than the very short time scale of a week that was way above average for you, and be consistent with that. So let's talk a bit more about the specifics of the AeroTune power test, where you can get test your VO2 max and your VLA max and get some of these things that we talked about, like the volume recommendations and so on. So how does the test work? Can you describe that a bit?
Yes. So we designed two tests, an indoor and outdoor test, and we constantly develop these kind of things. And So the outdoor test, we do a sprint test, a 20-second sprint test, then we do a 4-minute test, and then we do a 20-minute test. So we use these tests because everyone knows how they work, or most of the people who are doing it have kind of an idea. So, and out of that, we calculate the VO2 max and the maximal lactate steady state and the Vela max. So it's pretty simple. Yeah. Maybe you do it in 2 days. We could recommend that. We are also working on another protocol, but maybe that's, I will tell you when it's time. And the indoor test, we use a REM test, 20 watts per minute, depending on, what's your weight and stuff like that. Maybe you start at 80 watts or 60 watts and going up, so that we have like a time of, I don't know, 12-40 minutes and reach the highest point. And then we have also a 20-minute test, and then we calculate it.
Yeah.
This is how it works. And so what you do is you take the files from, I don't know, which platform you use, or maybe directly from your Garmin or Wahoo, whatever you have, and then you upload it, and then it's in a second later, it's automatically calculated, and you have all your values. And due to the fact that there is no one sitting and looking at the data, it's algorithms that are doing it. We can make it quite cheap. So for €25, I think. Yeah,
that's really great to make it available to any athlete. Essentially, I love that pricing policy of yours. And also, of course, you have the thing that I interviewed Sebastian Schlurike about back in the day in episode 97, 98. You still have the aerodynamic testing, of course, as well through the Garmin Connect IQ app that people can do outdoors. And I think I heard you talk on the Endurance Innovation podcast about maybe being able to at some point combine the two, so you can make like race pacing plans based on your aerodynamics and your metabolic testing.
Yes. It sounds a bit easier than it actually is, because we already started calculating things, and maybe what's the best pacing or power output on a special course. And we had like an average power output, and then we have like a dynamic. And so there was not much difference. So, and then we have to start thinking about, okay, we have some phosphates in our body. Maybe we use that and accelerating and things like that. So there are some studies from car engineering, pretty good ones, nice mathematical solutions. So we use that at some point. And, if you do a test, a power test, you always have the aero test also included. And actually the aero test is for free, even if you don't want to use the power test. And and you can do the test for a whole month. So what, as you know, as a coach, the problem is if someone is like overpacing, underpacing, and there's a car in front of you, and there's a truck, and the course was not very well chosen by the athlete, and you have to say, okay, sorry, we have to do it again. So we give the opportunity to test for a whole month. So if you messed up some test, you can do it again and again and again.
Yeah.
And even if you want to see adaptation that maybe that occur in 3 weeks' time, you can do that. Yeah. Start with it, do some hard block training, VO2 max, and test again and see what happens. So this is the idea, democratizing testing, so to say.
That's fantastic. And of course, we'll have that all linked to in the show notes, so people can go and have a look. One thing we talked about in our previous conversation was the difference that you might expect in indoor versus outdoor testing. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. We always have heat accumulation and things like that, inertia and inorganic phosphates. And this can end up in problems. Yeah. So you have some power output you can't produce inside if you compare it with outside. Yeah. So, and this also leads to the intensity zones you maybe you should use inside. Yeah. If you do a Swift race or Swift training, you maybe should lower your power output due to core temperature and all these other things. Yeah. And, so these are the differences. Yeah. Mm. So you can calculate, outdoor numbers indoor, of course, but is it useful to use indoor? I'm not sure about that always.
Basically, the advice would be to test as you train. Like if you mostly train outdoors and test outdoors, and vice versa.
Yes. Yeah. Test indoor and test outdoors, and then you see there's a difference.
Yeah,
and some athletes, if you have well trained athletes with maybe not the highest Vela max, they are pretty close what they can do indoor and outdoor.
Right? Yeah.
If you have someone, and maybe not like maybe 55 kilo or 60 kilo, very low body fat and a very high surface area compared to the size, they are more able to produce these numbers inside than compared to someone who's like 90 kilos and has like 20% of body fat because of overheating, for example.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Then just to finish up before the rapid fire questions, is there anything I should have asked you that that I didn't? Anything that you think would be interesting for the listeners to hear about?
No, I think we covered a lot. Of course, there are many things we can talk more and in detail, periodization and things like that. But this will will take a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm sure we will not find the right answer to that because it's such a big field and there are so many explanations and ideas, and actually everything works in some way. So, and so Mo, I think we covered everything before we start.
The rapid fire questions.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's move on to them then. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Due to the fact that we have internet, I talked about that with my son a few days ago. You can look up everything. So I don't have any special resource, and there's some kind of website. Of course, you have nice research websites and things like that. So I'm pretty open with that. And you have some nice podcasts and blog, and you read, and you know people from Twitter, and you look at the stuff they are doing. And so I don't have any special thing. And if it comes to books, I'm also not like, there's not this one book I would recommend. There's actually no sports science book, or maybe the one from Mujica I like a lot.
Yep.
And because it's, you have like a nice overview, and you have all the nice studies, and you can look it up. So this is quite good. And
endurance training, science, and application.
Yes,
is the name of that.
What I also like is the one from Magnus,
Science of Running. Yep.
Yes, and his podcast is also quite nice. Yep. Because what I like is he's pretty into science, so he's very good. But they always have like this human factor from training, and this is what I really like. As a coach, you always have to keep that in mind. We don't train robots. And another book is. Surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman, and stories from Richard Feynman, which I love a lot. If you want to know how real science works, not sports science, I mean like physics and stuff like that, you should really look that. And you see how the most genius person maybe on Earth the last century worked, and he was always curious, and you always have to keep that in mind. So I really like that book a lot. And I don't know how often I read it. It's fun.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Next, what's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
I thought about that a lot. But to be honest, there is, of course, we have heart rate, we have power meters and stuff like that. But maybe getting a step back, and I see that in elite athletes, and there's no gear, but their own feeling, the RPE, if you maintain a good feeling of your body and what you're able to and how to push, this is the ability to do that. There's no machine to do that. But this would be, if there is some kind of gear that can tell me my RPE, this would be it.
Yeah.
So, and maybe the second one would be a heart rate monitor.
Yeah.
Because it gives me a direct feedback. A power meter is always like what put I in and not what I get out.
Mm. And finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
That's complicated. Having a, first of all, family first. Yeah. And the person you're sitting beside on a Sunday afternoon and watching a movie is more important than having success in, I don't know, making money and stuff like that. So this doesn't make you happy. The other thing is, of course, working like constant, as I told you, and as I tell everyone, and don't be too focused. Yeah, life is not a straight line. So always, and not always going full throttle, just easy and maybe being lazy, just sitting in a corner, thinking about things for maybe 2 or 3 hours. I do that regularly. I do nothing. I just metabolize myself and start thinking. And surround your people that you like. Avoid people that don't, that are not funny, because this is not human. So always have like someone around you that is funny, and avoid people that are constantly talking about their success, because usually they have a problem with themselves. So this is my life advice.
That is fantastic life advice. Really good. All right. Well, finally, how can people follow you? Are you active on social media? Of course, we'll have the Aerotune links in the show notes. Do you have a coaching website, perhaps? Can you tell the listeners about where they might be able to find you?
I don't have any Twitter. Of course, I have some. I have a Twitter, but I don't tweet. And I have an Instagram, and I also have Facebook, but I hardly do put anything on that. But if someone is writing me something on Instagram, I reply, of course. But I don't have any coaching site, so yep. Usually the people find me, and I'm happy with that. And as I'm more like a maybe quiet person, I'm not like yelling out.
Yeah.
And but I'm always happy to talk. So don't be afraid of contacting me.
Yeah. And I will have the links to Aerotune, so people can find that anyway. So yes. The work that you do there with Sebastian Schlurike is really great. All right. Well, thank you so much, Björn. This has been a fantastic discussion, and I think that it will be really, really well appreciated by the listeners. So thank you from me and on behalf of all the listeners.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did talking to Björn, not just in this interview, but also we had a long chat a week or so before conducting the interview. And in these conversations, I've learned a lot from Björn. I would consider him a really big authority when it comes to metabolism and coaching in general, super knowledgeable and a super nice guy as well. So really the highest respect for him. I have a lot of links in the show notes for those interested in learning more to Aerotune's website and social media, where you can check out the Aerotune power test if you're interested in that. As Björn said, it's a really, really quite cheap test. So it's a great a great thing that Airtune are doing with democratizing the access to high-level testing. I'll also link to the Endurance Innovation podcast that I mentioned, where Björn was first interviewed, and thanks to Michael and Andrew for doing that interview, because that's how I found out about Björn in the first place. And I'll link to my episode, my interview that I did with Sebastian Schlurike, who is the Airtune founder, and that was back in episode 90, and also to the interviews I've done with Sebastian Weber and Jan Olbrecht, where we have discussed things like VLA Max and VO2 Max before, if you want to dig deeper into the whole physiology and metabolism discussion that we had with Björn today. Finally, if you're interested in coaching services or training plans, do check out what we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. We really think that we can help athletes of all different levels help achieve whatever your goals may be, whether you're a seasoned pro or you are a beginner athlete getting started in endurance sports. And big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out Roka's wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Zen 8. Use the Zen 8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and stamina, even when you don't have time to go to the pool or pools are closed, and getting that extra frequency of stimulus with short but effective workouts at home. You can get 20% off your order on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.